Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. You're confident when it comes to your work and life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same confidence when it comes to refinancing your existing mortgage or buying a home. It lets you understand all the details so you can be confident that you're getting the right mortgage for you. Go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint.
From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Tom Asbrook, and this is On Point. In 2012, Kansas was hailed in GOP circles as the great Republican model for tax-cutting growth. Republican Governor Sam Brownback led the way. Taxes were slashed, but the growth, not so much. Kansans were soon hurting. Last week, Republican legislators rebelled. Republican legislators said enough, overthrew the tax-cutting model, raised taxes, at a time when the Trump administration is headed just the other way in Washington. Up next on Point, the Kansas Revolt and what it means. You can join us on air or online with this conversation as always on What is the Lesson from Kansas? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. Later in this hour, Trump's cabinet piles on the praise in its first meeting. Presidential historian John Meacham looks at just how outside American tradition that is. But first, to Kansas. Last week, Kansas lawmakers voted to override Governor Sam Brownback's veto of tax reform increases and instead chose to increase taxes by $1.2 billion over the next 2 years. Here's reporting from 41 Action News in Kansas City the night of the vote.
Breaking tonight at 10, within the past few minutes, Kansas lawmakers approved a massive tax increase in Kansas.
41 Action News reporter Ariel Rothfield joins us now live from the Capitol, where they just overrode Governor Sam Brownback's veto. Ariel.
Yeah, Rhiannon, we're standing outside of the House chambers where you can see people still funneling outside. Within minutes, the House voted to override Governor Brownback's veto. They needed 84 votes, but they passed the bill with 88.
With Republicans in the lead, let's go to Kansas and ask what happened here. In Lawrence, Kansas, Jim McLean joins us, managing director of the Kansas News Service. He's been covering the Kansas, what many are calling, Republican revolt. Jim, welcome to On Point. Thank you very much for being here.
You bet. Hi, Tom.
Paint the picture for us. What did Sam Brownback promise and deliver in 2012, and what happened last week?
Well, you've already started painting that picture for folks. He did. He promised essentially a red state nirvana in Kansas. We're going to cut taxes drastically, eliminate individual income taxes over several years. He called it the glide path to zero. And as you mentioned earlier, he promised it would be a shot of adrenaline to the heart of the Kansas economy. But what happened, frankly, since 2012 is revenue in the first fiscal year after the tax cuts, revenue just fell through the floor, dropped by $700 million. And even heading into this last legislative session, the state had a structural imbalance in its budget of $1.4 billion. And every year, year after year, lawmakers were struggling to balance the budget. They were resorting to all kinds of accounting tricks. They siphoned money from the highway program, and we had a state hospital decertified. And there was an inability to solve a long-running legal dispute over school funding in Kansas. And so things simply weren't working well, and voters recognized that.
So what happened last week with the Republicans? Who did he lose? I mean, at one time, he had a pretty solid phalanx of Republican support. Everybody was gung-ho for this.
He did, but the 2016 election really changed all that. Several moderate Republicans and Democrats who were challenging conservative Republicans and or running for open seats. Several conservative Republicans kind of looked at the landscape and decided at the last minute not to run for reelection. But anyway, there was a big influx of new lawmakers, and they came in. They campaigned on the slogan of, quote unquote, fixing the mess in Topeka, and voters elected them, understanding that would probably mean tax increases. And so the infusion of those new legislators made a big, big difference. And then there were several Republicans, even some who had voted initially for the tax cuts. Senate Majority Leader Jim Denning from the Kansas City suburb of Overland Park comes to mind. He's the Senate Majority Leader. He just finally acknowledged they weren't working, and he wasn't going to be go down with the ship, so to speak. And so, you know, he reversed course and voted for the tax increase and then ultimately voted to override the governor. And so, as you said, it truly was a revolt. Mostly led by new faces in the legislature, but also some folks who had been there since the 2012 tax cuts.
Pretty incredible Republican turnaround. Republican Senate Majority Leader Jim Denning saying, I've always backed up and mopped up my mess. That's what I'm doing now. But he's talking there, as you well know, Jim, about a path that was hailed all over the place as the Republican way, the Republican model
not just in Topeka, but right across the country, certainly in Washington. Last week, we had Sam Brownback, the governor, coming out denouncing this decision of Kansas legislators, to end his live experiment. Here he was, Brownback.
My estimation, I think the tax policy move last night, the legislature's a wrong move. I think it's wrong for the long-term view of the state of Kansas. I think it's wrong for growth. I don't think it's going to be a positive for this state moving down the road.
Jim McLean has covered all this for the Kansas News Service. I mean, the idea was, who wouldn't like it? Cut taxes, get a great economy. I mean, it really, it sounds fantastic. Who wouldn't like lower taxes and a strong economy and the whole thing working wonderfully? What about the economic side? Did that show up? I mean, we had a good 5 years here, 4 or 5 years. Did the adrenaline to the heart of the Kansas economy show up, Jim?
No, in fact, it didn't. And the governor would maintain that his tax policies were slowly making a difference in the Kansas economy. He talked about new small business formation as being a direct result, particularly in the Kansas City area, of the tax cuts, which, by the way, one of the facets of the tax cuts essentially eliminated taxes for about 300,000 owners of some types of businesses and farmers. And so the idea was they would take those tax savings, reinvest them in the business, lead to new hiring, et cetera. But again, I think the miscalculation is that few businesses are going to make that type of decision based on a state income tax savings. There are other bigger factors involved. And so the plain fact of the matter was that as other states started recovering from the recession, Kansas lagged behind the country in job creation and a lot of other economic measures. And so it became apparent to most people that the shot of adrenaline that the governor promised simply wasn't showing up. He, as you heard in the cut, is yet to acknowledge that. But as we mentioned before, a lot of other Republicans who initially were allied with the governor, who supported the tax cuts, hoping they would work as advertised, finally came around to the determination that they weren't, in fact, working and they needed to just kind of cut their losses.
Zero taxes for a lot of small businesses and farmers. But did it work? Well, Kansas City Star went out and talked with folks. Here was Mike Fall, a farmer from Overbrook, Kansas, criticized the effectiveness of that tax cut for small business owners.
As a small business person, you got a tax break, and it was meant to go out and hire people to work for you. And what you did with it, it amounted to $4,000 or $5,000 a year. Well, you can't hire anybody for that, so what you would do is just put it in your pocket.
Didn't work. Last week, Republicans said no thanks to their own sitting Republican governor, revolted, and have turned it around. $1.2 billion in tax hikes coming to Kansas now. Jim McLean with Kansas News Service, please stand by there in Lawrence, Kansas. I want to go to Fairway, Kansas, and Kansas Representative Melissa Rooker, Republican, rep for the 25th District, includes Fairway, part of the Kansas City metro area. She voted for the tax increase last week. Representative Rooker, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Tom.
Why did you do it?
We needed to. We run state government. We have services to deliver to the people. We have a court order to increase funding to our schools. And we are at the end of the line of all of those accounting tricks that Jim alluded to. We were out of options. And the state can't print money, so something had to be done. And we knew it.
What does that say? What about the model? You know, Kansas was prized as the model. Sam Brownback and many others wanted this to work out like gangbusters and show it off and replicate it around the country. What does it leave you thinking, Melissa?
Well, it served a purpose to prove the model didn't work as intended. There were a lot of reasons, but you can't, I keep saying this, you cannot cut your way to growth. You've got to invest. You've got to maintain state infrastructure. You've got to maintain the capacity to deliver services and run government efficiently via appropriate levels of staffing and investment in technology and the like.
Is that heresy for you to say that as a Republican rep in Kansas now, Melissa Rooker, or not?
No, I don't believe so. I mean, it's a more traditional Republican approach, isn't it? It's classic conservatism. It's the avoidance of risk. It's not wanting to put things on the line and rock the boat too much. You look at what the credit agencies did to our credit rating as a state. What we were doing was actually pretty radical. And in a state that has a long, rich history of center-right political leanings, the state that gave us Eisenhower and Kassebaum and Dole and people like that, it is a very traditional approach to things.
You say it was pretty radical, but the very path that you and other Republicans in Kansas have now rejected is kind of the path that Donald Trump is proposing for the country in Washington right now with his tax changes.
It doesn't make it a good idea, does it?
Oh, I guess I can't say that. How did you – you were elected, I think, in 2013. Am I right, Melissa?
It was the 2012 election.
2012.
2013 was my first session, yes.
So how did you begin to come to the position that this wasn't working? Was it your constituents coming and complaining about missing services? Was it your direct observation? What?
You know, Tom, when this tax plan passed in 2012, the projections that our state fiscal analysts provided showed that it would not pay off. And so this was something that I was elected knowing we needed to rectify. So this is something that did not come as a surprise. In fact, this year, it marks the first time in my five legislative sessions that I have voted yes for a tax plan or a state budget, because it's the first time that we've done responsible things with our fiscal policy.
Are you taking heat from Tea Party members or, you know, national organizations that don't agree with the path that you and others have now put Kansas on, the revolt?
No.
You don't have the Koch brothers. You don't have the Koch brothers calling you and saying, "Come on, come on."
No,
we will crush you.
Aren't calling me? No, no. The district I represent is tuned in and understands. They value the quality of their schools. They value sufficient infrastructure and technology and resources. They want state government functioning. I talk to a lot of people who resent the level of federal taxes they pay, but
yep.
they say, you know, I know what the state does for me. It's more present in their everyday lives, and these are folks that just want it done right.
Support for On Point and the following message come from Rocket Mortgage by Quicken Loans. Chances are you're confident when it comes to your work, your hobbies, and your life. Rocket Mortgage gives you that same level of confidence when it comes to buying a home or refinancing your existing home loan. With Rocket Mortgage, you can apply simply and understand fully so you can mortgage confidently. To get started, go to rocketmortgage.com/onpoint. Equal housing lender, licensed in all 50 states. NMLSconsumeraccess.org, number 3030.
I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking this hour with the Kansas Republican revolt against their own great Republican experiment with deep tax cuts and draconian cutbacks. They've overruled their own Republican governor to say enough or too much or stop as of last week. Sam Brownback, the governor there, came in 2012 with deep, deep tax cuts, promised a shot of adrenaline to the heart of the Kansas economy. That did not happen. And all kinds of what holes opened up in services there. And last week, Republicans said no to their own governor, overrode his veto of a tax increase of $1.2 billion over the next 2 years. You can join us this hour. Have you followed the Kansas story? Do you remember when Governor Sam Brownback was hailed as a Republican hero, when Kansas tax cutting and cutbacks were hailed by the GOP as the model for the nation? And do you see why Kansas Republicans are now overriding their governor to turn it around? Did they just do it wrong in Kansas? Is there a right way to do it that would be better? Do you want to see the Trump administration push this through federally? Jim McLean is with us. He's managing director of the Kansas News Service, with us from Lawrence, Kansas, and from Fairway, Kansas, outside Kansas City. State Representative Melissa Rooker is here, one of those Republicans who last week voted for the tax increase, voted to override the veto of Sam Brownback. It was Brownback back in 2012, addressing criticisms of the then new tax cuts and assuring everybody that public needs would be met after the cuts.
Now, all major policy changes, just like changes in life, are met with understandable criticisms and skepticisms. But let me say clearly, we will meet the needs of our schools and our most vulnerable, and our roads will get built.
We'll meet the needs. The roads will be built. And let's bear in mind that all this is going on in Kansas while in Washington. Donald Trump, it's just sort of a one-page sketch. We don't know what it's going to be, but there's a promise of a major tax push there. This was late April. Treasury Secretary Steve Mnuchin talking at an event sponsored by the Hill newspaper, publicizing the administration's, the federal administration's, new plan.
This is going to be the biggest tax cut and the largest tax reform in the history of our country. And we are committed to seeing this through.
There's the Trump path to making America great again, or part of it. Jim McLean, in the Kansas case, where did the holes show up? Where did it really pinch? What made constituents sit up and say, hey, wait a minute, sure, I'd like lower taxes, but I'm not sure I like this?
Well, let's take a look at going back to what Governor Brownback said. That was, I think, taken from one of his State of the State addresses.
Okay.
And he said, and the highways, quote unquote, the highways will get built.
Yep.
Let's just take that for a second. They didn't. They didn't get built. In fact, we were just kind of embarking on a multi-year, multi-billion dollar highway building infrastructure program. And year after year, since the tax cuts were approved, they've literally canceled several of the highway projects that were on the list under that program. And heading into this session, they didn't even have enough money in the state transportation department to do basic maintenance on the state's roads. And so the legislature this year had to increase the Department of Transportation's borrowing authority by $400 million just so they could do basic maintenance on the roads. And a lot of people thought that was antithetical to conservatism when you're borrowing money to pay for essentially basic day-to-day services. And so that's one example, I think, of where things kind of fell apart.
Is it, we have seen in the past, and maybe in the Kansas case, critics from Washington, conservative critics, saying, well, you cut the taxes, but you just didn't cut your spending enough. That's your problem. You didn't complete the magic formula.
That's right. And there were calls for the last 4 or 5 years, and Melissa can talk about this as well, to cut spending. The conservatives, in fact, just last week when they were putting through the budget, said we refused to vote for this budget, saying it spent too much money and we should be cutting our spending instead. And yet the very late in the session, the proposal they unveiled to balance the state budget had very few spending cuts in it. Instead, they were going to securitize the state's tobacco settlement fund and do more one-time borrowing from different funds and delaying payments to the state retirement system. And I think that is what moderate Republicans and Democrats and, frankly, constituents and voters got tired of seeing. Spending wasn't getting cut. But as Melissa said, these accounting tricks were being used year after year after year to balance the budget, which created a structural deficit in the budget that was much deeper than the gap that they had to close from year to year.
Representative Rooker, Melissa Rooker, you're there representing the 25th District in Kansas. Was there sort of locker room conversation? I don't mean that in the jocular way, but backroom conversation saying, if only we had a little more spine, we would have cut spending and this might have worked. We just didn't follow through. Did you hear that kind of conversation within the Republican ranks?
Well, let me gently push back a bit because Jim and I get along great, but I would point out that we actually have cut the budget 9 times under this governor. Mm-hmm. It's a variety of the official budget cuts or after the fact rescission bills and governor's allotments. In order to make ends meet, we actually have reduced the number of state employees by 3,000 full-time positions. We have kept spending as human caseloads have increased and spending in certain non-discretionary areas of our state budget has gone up. We have held state spending to less than 1% growth over the last 6 years. So we actually did enact spending controls, but there is so much that has gone on in the state that requires more investment. And last year, the conservative-led House commissioned an efficiency study from an outside firm that came back. It was, it supposedly targeted close to $2 billion worth of savings, but most of it was just cost shifting. A significant portion of it was shifting the cost from the state contribution to employees in the state health insurance system by putting them in a high deductible plan and shifting the burden to the employees. We have waiting lists for our waiting lists for the disabled in the state. We have we have, I mentioned earlier, a court order to increase spending on our schools.
Kansas Supreme Court saying do it.
All kinds of remedies, right?
Yeah.
And that deadline is June 30th, so that played into it. Jim mentioned the securitization of the Master Tobacco Settlement Funds. Let me explain that in Kansas, when that settlement was created, the Kansas legislature made a decision to create the Kansas Endowment for Youth that would take the annual payouts from that fund, invest them, and use the interest earned on the principal to fund the early childhood programs in the state.
Yep.
During the Brownback administration, the principal has been swept out of the key fund, and all we're left with are the annual payments. It is those future payouts that the governor was proposing in his budget that we securitize in order to have a one-time lump sum of money to use this year to fill the gap in the budget.
Wow.
So that was really the key component where my colleagues and I drew the line and said enough.
Once and done, just won't do it. You've got ongoing needs there. Representative Rooker, Jim McLean, standby. Patrick Miller joins us right now as well from Kansas, Lawrence, Kansas, assistant professor of political science, University of Kansas. Patrick Miller, thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. Nice to be with you.
What went wrong?
Oh, what a complex question. I think we'll ultimately turn the tide here. I mean, elections have consequences. And if you had not had the blowback against Governor Brownback's policies in the 2016 election, in both the Republican primaries and for Democrats in the November election,
mm-hmm.
none of what happened would have been possible. And I think ultimately, you know, you went into that with a governor who was the most unpopular in the country, with approval ratings hanging around 20%, constant negative headlines about cutbacks and sacrifices on basic services like schools and roads. And for a lot of people, you know, the ideology ultimately faded away, and this became a matter of negative headlines and quality of life issues that benefited both Democrats and Republican moderates and really enabled the kind of cross-factional veto override reversal of this experiment that you saw the other week.
Jim McLean used the phrase red state nirvana. That was the dream. That was the goal. Does Sam Brownback still use that, or has he defended all this last week? Is he still talking that way? Have he and other Republicans of that perspective conceded that the Kansas experiment has failed?
I think largely not. I mean, certainly you have Senator Denning, who has said in his own words that it was a mistake and he reversed himself. And
this
certainly
is the Senate Majority
override,
Leader in Kansas, yeah.
Right. And certainly the override would not have been possible without enough conservative Republicans joining Republican moderates and Democrats. But I think for the most part, most conservative Republicans still back the governor's policies, you know, still tell us the sun is shining in Kansas, and if we only let it run long enough, that we'll see the benefits out of this. But I think if you look at this from outside of Kansas, and not just Kansas, you look at Louisiana that instituted a very similar kind of model under Governor Jindal, Oklahoma. I think, and especially you look at Republican governors in other states who have openly knocked Kansas and Louisiana for the budget problems that we've had, saying, you know, let's not become Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I think there is a signal sent out that maybe ideology does not translate into the kind of economic growth and benefits you necessarily think it does, but it will hurt your bottom line in the budget.
Let's bring our listeners in. Nate in Omaha, Nebraska, next door there. Nate, thank you for calling. You're on the air.
Hi, Tom. You asked Patrick Miller what went wrong, and he says it's complicated. From a worker's perspective, I just don't believe it's that complicated. You know, we've been doing this as a country since Ronald Reagan. It's trickle-down economics is all it is. And the jury's in. The 1% have all the wealth. We're in another gilded age. They haven't reinvested that into job growth. We have crumbling infrastructure. We have jobs that don't pay the bills. We have kids going to college and going tens of thousands of dollars in debt, still can't get a job that pays their bills when they get out. They're moving back home. We're turning to drugs. return to entertainment, the pacifists, we're angry, populism's on the rise. The jury's in on this economic theory. When are we going to be truthful that trickle-down economics does not work?
Nate, you put it about as succinctly as it could be put, and let me hold that right there. I'm really glad for your call from Omaha. Thank you for that. Let's get one more here. Nate, we won't ignore it. Let me get one more. Randy in Burnside, Kentucky. Randy, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom.
Hi.
Hi. My point of view is I'm a retired union iron worker, and Kansas Project, like Missouri and Kentucky, they're all right-to-work states. Jobs don't flow there. They flood out of there when you have right-to-work. Everything goes down, even the non-unions.
Right-to-work meaning unions have a very hard time in those states.
Exactly. Right to work, you know, if they, you know, we're going to let somebody join our union and not pay union dues, that don't happen to the iron workers. We don't have what we call slugs.
So what's going on? What's the net effect, Randy?
Well, the effect is they think, you know, I was living in Missouri when this happened, and they think jobs are just going to flood there because we're right to work. Well, jobs don't flood there. Jobs flood out of there because it brings down everybody's standards, even the working class. And like you say, the fellow before me, the 1%, this is trickle-down economics at its finest. And, you know, the blind could see this coming a long time ago, but the Republicans don't. They don't care for the working class. They're corporate, corporate, corporate. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
I appreciate your call, Randy. The jury is in, Nate says, in Omaha. And you hear Randy right there. One more. Carlos, Austin, Texas. Carlos, you're on the air.
Hi, Tom. Thank you very much for taking my call.
Yes, sir.
You know, there's a longstanding joke that Democrats don't ever open an economics book. And the reality is that Republicans are completely ignoring a pillar of economic theory, which is Ricardian equivalence, which basically states that you can't cut taxes in order to enable growth in the long run. It only works in the short run. So that credit card that Ronald Reagan decided to swipe, we've continued to swipe over and over again. It doesn't work like that. And by doing that, they're enabling the crumbling of the country while still propping up corporate welfare, which is essentially what we're paying for with the little tax base that's being eroded that should be going towards services. So all of these callers are correct. And this should be a moment to really take pause and consider the policies of the last 30 years. Because that representative who was saying, well, this is classical conservatism. No, classical conservatism means you don't do that kind of stuff, like swipe a credit card and borrow a ton of money and ruin an entire generation.
Well, to be fair to Melissa, she's looking back before that kind of policy, Melissa Rooker, and saying, I don't want to go down that road exactly. Wow, Carlos, I appreciate your call as well. Patrick Miller, geez, callers are like on fire here and very concise about this, and yet isn't the Kansas experiment more or less what's embedded in the Trump tax plans as far as we understand them, which have been laid on the table in Washington now?
Oh, yes. You know, one of our representatives here, Lynn Jenkins, you know, bless her heart, she's been in Republican leadership. She tried to argue the other day that these are not the same policies in effect. I mean, and to an extent, she has a degree of accuracy to this because the plan in Kansas was to bring income taxes to zero, which is not part of the federal plan. But the federal plan does mimic the Kansas plan in a lot of different ways with respect to business taxation, income tax rates. You know, I think the key difference between what happened in Kansas, and I respect the caller's point of view, you know, but most voters are looking at this from what's the bottom line on my quality of life. And if Democrats want a message on this and win, they need to talk about it from that perspective and not trickle down this and Ricardian that.
Okay.
But, you know, if you look at the plan that's in D.C., which I think has Speaker Ryan's strong support, I mean, I think the key difference is D.C. doesn't have to balance a budget the way that Kansas does, and not, they don't necessarily have to make the kind of cuts that we made in Kansas to make the math of this work. And also, D.C. Republicans—
That's kind of a cheesy rationale if it doesn't work to say, well, we don't have to balance a budget. That doesn't sound very
classically— we're running a budget deficit anyway. I mean, we haven't had a balanced budget since, what, 1999, 2000?
Hold that thought, Patrick, if you would, because Melissa Rooker, I know I have to let you go at the end of this segment. Representative Rooker, what's your advice to Republicans in Washington as they contemplate their next step on national taxation policy?
Well, be very careful, because as a country, we already have a deficit, as Patrick was alluding to, and we need the revenue to invest in this country. We need to fix infrastructure around the country. We need to invest in technology and security upgrades. We certainly need money to provide some of the human services and the thing that, you know, there is a role for government in our lives. So being careful to right size and provide appropriate services is key. And this plan had no measurement for whether it produced the desired job growth. It just handed out the tax benefits. Mm.
Melissa Rooker, thank you very much for being with us today. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Representative Melissa Rooker of Kansas 25th District, Patrick Miller at the University of Kansas, Jim McLean at Kansas News Service, please stand by. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We'll be right back. Talking this hour about the Kansas Republican revolt against their own great Republican experiment with deep tax cuts and draconian cutbacks was supposed to be a red state nirvana, a glide path to zero on taxes, Governor Sam Brownback said when it all got launched back in 2012. Last week, Republicans led the way in saying no thank you to this and voted for tax increases. You heard a Republican representative here in this hour saying it just wasn't working. We needed to invest in our public life. All this at a time when in Washington, the Trump administration is pushing a still kind of vague, but nevertheless pretty clear, huge tax cuts on the same kind of theory. You can join us this hour. What's the lesson in the Kansas story about tax cuts, about supply side dreams, about real people's lives? Is Washington paying attention or headed down the Kansas road? How do we strike the right balance of tax and spend in this country? Before the end of this hour, we're going to look at that kind of extraordinary Trump cabinet meeting yesterday when everybody went around and praised the great leader. We'll talk with presidential historian John Meacham about that spectacle. Right now, Jim McLean is with us from Kansas News Service, Patrick Miller from the University of Kansas. Whole country's been watching this, though. Max Ehrenfreund is with us as well from Washington, policy reporter with the Washington Post. He's written about the Kansas experiment and its turnaround last week. Max, thank you very much for being with us.
Well, thanks for having me.
Is this a tempest in a you know, Kansas bottle, or is there a national echo to this, Max?
Well, I certainly wouldn't describe it as a tempest in a teapot, because Kansas is an important state, and you know, the economy of that state is important to the people who live there. But I also think that, you know, Republicans around the country are indeed looking at what's happening in Kansas, and at least in some cases, you know, depending on their politics and their inclinations, they're viewing Kansas as a cautionary example of what not to do, either with respect to tax cuts or spending or the specific kinds of provisions that the Republican legislature there enacted under Brownback 5 years ago. And so everyone is watching carefully what's happening in Kansas and coming to their own conclusions, I would say.
So do you see some very careful blueprint design in Washington with the Trump tax changes that would differentiate them from essentially from what Sam Brownback tried in Kansas, Max?
Well, no. The rough outline of the proposal that the Trump administration put out a couple of months ago is extremely similar to what Brownback tried in Kansas. And in particular, there is a provision in Brownback's plan that allowed small business owners essentially to avoid taxes altogether on their income. And of course, the result of that was that many people in Kansas pretended to be small business owners, sure, so they wouldn't have to pay taxes. And Trump's plan contains a very similar proposal.
So here we are, looking maybe at something like the same road. Des Moines, Iowa, Aaron is calling. Aaron, you're on the air. Thank you for calling.
Hi, Tom. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah.
I just wanted to talk about Kansas education system and how really it's been lagging behind for many years before 2012. And it was interesting that the deadline for the mandatory increase in funding was part of the reasons why Republicans wanted to vote against Brownback.
This is the Kansas Supreme Court ruling that they had to pump it up, or they were in breach of their own constitution.
Yes, so I hope just the rest of the Republicans are also hoping to focus on education as well, and that's all I wanted to say. Thank you.
Erin,
and
I
grew up in Kansas, so I follow along, and I hope everybody in the country is too.
Voice of authority right there. Erin, thank you. In Iowa, Oklahoma, on the other side of Kansas here. Bob in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. Bob, you're on the air.
Thank you. Can you hear me okay?
Loud and clear, Bob. What's on your mind?
Well, thank you. Don't forget the Koch brothers, their Wichita, and the influence they've had on the legislative process. And the thing I want to say, this phrase that's being bantied around, elections have consequences. They certainly do, but that doesn't mean the people voted for this aversion and this indifference towards responsive government, democratic process.
Bob, we've got it. Patrick Miller, weigh in on the Koch brothers and the kind of network of ideological campaigners who may have helped Sam Brownback all the way along. Let's bear in mind, Paul Ryan used to work for Sam Brownback. They are there, as Bob says, in Wichita. Does it mean that Kansas legislators who defied Sam Brownback last week are going to face some kind of payback from these national hard right kind of lobbying groups and interests who have been pretty effective in promoting their view and of supply side economics as the way, Patrick?
Oh, it's possible for sure. I mean, the moderate conservative divide in Kansas is longstanding, and the Koch brothers and their allies and predecessors to the Kochs and the conservative movement before that have been part of this great back and forth of rewarding certain camps in Kansas politics. And right now in Republican politics in Kansas, the moderates are on a high. Conservatives will assuredly have their day again, as will moderates. You know, it'll be a back and forth. One thing I would point out looking at Kansas versus the country, if you want to extrapolate from this, is that, you know, in Kansas, when we speak of moderate Republicans, they span the spectrum from Republicans who are certifiably liberal to Republicans who are old school Bob Dole kind of Republicans. Mm-hmm. There really is no Melissa Rooker in D.C. in the Republican Party.
Why
right
not?
Now. Well, I mean, you look at like the old gypsy moth Republicans of the Northeast, your Olympia Snows, your Jim Jeffords have faded away. They've been replaced in primaries by strong conservatives. You know, even the most moderate Republicans in Congress right now would probably fit in the conservative camp in Kansas politics. You know, the D.C. Republicans are just not Bob Dole and Olympia Snow anymore. The entire brand, the entire party in D.C. has become something much more conservative. And so I think you can't really extrapolate the kind of factional politics that we have here to D.C. necessarily and say that there's going to be some big revolt of Republican moderates in Congress about this.
Max, do you see any kind of moderating influence on the likely tax package that ultimately gets firmly proposed here coming out of the Kansas experiment and Washington Republicans' reading of it?
Yeah, I'd agree. I think that Kansas's Republicans are very different from the Republicans here in Washington, D.C. Those here are much more conservative, and they've been becoming more conservative for about a decade or a little more than that. And so it is difficult to see where the moderating influence comes from, as you said. One very important question for us as we watch what Congress does with respect to taxes under President Trump is whether or not Republicans in Congress are willing to approve or vote for tax policy that would increase the deficit. And of course, increases in the deficit can have negative consequences for the economy as a whole. Even if they cut taxes for some, and that's what Kansas discovered, I think, over the past 5 years.
Jim McLean, bottom line, what do you think Kansas has learned from this 4 or 5 year experiment?
I think the bottom line in Kansas, and I go back to what Patrick and what I heard Melissa say, is that at least here, where government is theoretically closer to the people, what people concluded was, regardless of ideology, regardless of party affiliation, they simply wanted their government to work. I think that's what you also, I thought that kind of frustration helped lead Obama into the presidency and Trump and helped fuel Bernie Sanders' campaign. Voters across the country want to see their government work. And I think that's, Topeka is now responding to that call. Washington isn't.
Jim McLean with Kansas News Service out of Lawrence with us today. Jim, thank you so much for your time in this hour. Great to have you with us.
Happy to do it, Tom. Thanks a lot.
Max Ehrenfreund at the Washington Post in Washington. Max, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And Professor Patrick Miller at the University of Kansas, been watching it all there and around the country. Professor Miller, thank you for your time.
Thank you.
In a moment, we will look at the praise pylon at President Trump's cabinet meeting yesterday. This is On Point. Yesterday was President Trump's first full cabinet meeting. The press was invited in for the opening. The president called himself the most successful president ever, with a few exceptions. He then invited his cabinet members, each of them, to share a few words. And what followed was a lavish praise pylon by almost every member of the cabinet. It was a kind of odd spectacle. Joining me now in Chicago, from Chicago, is John Meacham, presidential historian and Pulitzer Prize-winning author. John Meacham, welcome back to On Point. Great to have you here.
Thanks, Tom. Appreciate it.
Listen with us for just a minute, John, to just a little bit. I mean, there were almost two dozen people at that big table, but I just want to share a flavor on tape here of what transpired once the president opened the floor. Here was, right off the bat, first one, Mike Pence, VP.
Greatest privilege of my life is to serve as vice president to a president who's keeping his word to the American people and assembling a team that's bringing real change, real prosperity, real strength back to our nation.
Greatest privilege of his life. Here, Health and Human Services Secretary Tom Price.
President, what an incredible honor it is to lead the Department of Health and Human Services at this pivotal time under your leadership. I can't thank you enough for the privilege that you've given me and the leadership that you've shown.
And one more, Chief of Staff Reince Priebus at the cabinet meeting.
On behalf of the entire senior staff around you, Mr. President, we thank you for the opportunity and the blessing that you've given us to serve your agenda and the American people, and we're continuing to work very hard every day to accomplish those goals.
Okay, we've got the idea. John Meacham, you're our presidential historian. To my ear, and I guess many of this sounded quite unusual, but you tell us, is there precedent for this kind of, wow, you're the greatest, Mr. President, and we're all going to say so one at a time with cameras rolling?
There's total precedent for you're the greatest, Mr. President, where we enter, as ever, new territory under the 45th president is with the cameras rolling in the cabinet room. The Oval Office, the cabinet room, the White House, Air Force One, has this remarkable capacity to render even the most staid and prideful and serious-minded people into, I'm going to use a technical historical term here, into jello throughout history. People around the president end up being impressed by the aura of power, the personality of the person. Remember, a politician's unit of commerce is to make you respect and even love them. I mean, that's what they do. The difference here, as you note, is that this was almost a formalized apprentice-like episode, where each person was to pledge their fealty and express their indebtedness to Trump. The best analogy I can think of, and it was something that happened in private, is the Nixon tapes, which I highly recommend to everyone.
Okay, great.
Are full of moments where people would call in, particularly after Nixon gave a speech. You know, he was never wildly comfortable giving televised addresses, despite the fact that he thought he was pretty good at it from Checkers forward.
Yep.
And he used to arrange, the staff used to arrange, for members of the cabinet, for governors like Ronald Reagan, to call in after he had given a speech to tell Nixon how well he had done. One of the most heartbreaking moments, to some extent, in modern presidential history is on the night that he announced that Haldeman and Ehrlichman were leaving office. This was April 30th, 1973.
Yep.
And he hoped that this was going to turn the page on Watergate. He asks Bob Haldeman to call around and drum up those calls about the speech,
oh my gosh,
which he had fired, essentially, yep, Bob Haldeman.
Give me the reassurance I need. Line it up. Let me hear it.
Exactly. Even though he just fired the guy.
Yeah.
So we're sort of in that zone, and I think the Nixon analogy is the closest one I can think of.
But isn't it quite a different zone when it has this kind of almost ceremonial, formalized, public presentation. I mean, that where you sort of roll cameras and everybody steps up one by one to say in front of the whole country on camera how great you are, dear leader. Yeah. That's where it starts to feel kind of banana republically, or even North Korea, you know, Kim Jong-un. Or, I mean,
yeah.
That kind of thing. It's like a toady fest of our cabinet members.
Yeah, my thought was that, you know, they were all sort of maybe trying out for the Baghdad Bob role. Remember the Saddam spokesman who, while the missiles were falling, said, there are no missiles here. You know, it's yet another example, and a vivid one, of this not-so-subtle shift in Trump world, where it is entirely the cult of personality. And the other interesting thing here, I think, is all this followed Trump saying, laughably so, ludicrously so, that this was the most active administration, with possibly the exception of Franklin Roosevelt, in history, that he had passed legislation, that he had done so much.
Give us a truth check on that.
How much time you got? I mean, almost no legislation has passed. They've repealed Obamacare. We don't know what's in the bill in the Senate. He signed a number of executive orders, but many of them are just sort of exhortations. Several of the serious-minded executive orders he signed have been stopped by the courts, in a good sign that rule of law is prevailing. But it's a case of, you know, Trump has always suffered from what I might call superlativitis, right? And so he has to be the most this, the best that. And he has to hear constant praise of himself. And he has now put the official officers, including one constitutional officer, the vice president of the United States. Remember, vice presidents are, you know, serve in administration, but he's the only man in that room, I think, who has an oath to and has his own constitutional role.
Yep.
I go back to I haven't spent a great deal of time watching The Apprentice, but this does remind one of the ethos of that, of the boardroom table, of people currying favor with Trump. And let's just remember, this is not a reality show. This is our reality.
That very clear yesterday as the president with his cabinet kind of showing maybe how he expects it to be done. You want to address me? Bend that knee a little bit.
Exactly.
John Meacham, thank you so much for being with us. Author of Thomas Jefferson, of American Lion, on Andrew Jackson, of Destiny and Power, Pulitzer Prize winning historian. Thank you very much for being with us, John.
Thanks, Tom.
Listeners, thank you for joining us today. As always, you can continue this conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. Follow us on Twitter and Facebook at On Point Radio. I'm on Twitter at Tom Ashbrook, NPR. This is On Point.